All right. Welcome back to the Africa Forum. We're speaking to my very, very special guest, Professor Gerald Horn, Moore's Professor of History and African American Studies. And we're talking about his book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. We remind you that this is one of the texts we're reading in the Africa Forum Book Club. It is book number 2, and we'll talk about book number 1 in a little while. Intellectual Warfare by Jacob Caruthers is book number 1. This is book number 2, and we're reading this now. We're going to invite Professor Horn once again to join us when the team is through reading, members of the book club in the studio, to have a discussion with us. We hope that you'll join us in Jamaica. I'm not putting you on the spot, Prof, but we hope you'll join us in Jamaica in August in August for a celebration of Mwalimu Marcus Mosiah Garvey. And if you do, that would be wonderful. All right. But just to go on, Professor, and I found this very interesting. I haven't finished reading the book, just so our listeners know. I'm not running ahead of the crowd. I'm reading with you. But I find this interesting in the book, that you talk about whiteness and so on. And this is something that you talk about on many different platforms. Earlier, you made reference to European settler colonialism in the Americas and talked about how important it is or useful it is to deal with some of the conflicts and the contradictions. And you mentioned the Ottoman Empire, for example, and you talked about the religious conflicts between the Muslims, the Christians, the Jews, Protestants and Catholics and so on, and how these conflicts were resolved on the common altar of race, as you call it. And so I want to talk about that because you're talking about a transition from religion to race, and I suppose that whiteness and white supremacy takes precedence here.
You are correct. And let me get a bit ahead of the story, then I'll come back.
Yes.
You have this transition, as you noted correctly, from religion as the axis of society, Christian societies or Protestant societies or Islamic societies, for example, and those not in those particular categories oftentimes being persecuted. And then, and I'll come back to this in a second in more detail, you have this transition, particularly in the 1600s, to race becoming the axis of society. I argue in a book that I wrote on the Haitian Revolution, which I would recommend to your listeners, Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, that with the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, which was a successful revolt of the enslaved against the European settlers, you have the diminishing of the role of the equation of being African and being a slave. And then in the 20th century, with the rise of unions, you have the rise of class as an axis of society. But then, of course, we all know what happens in the 20th century with the retreat of class as an axis of society. And therefore, you've had a sort of revival of religion and race as making a major comeback in the late 20th century and in the early 21st century, leading, of course, to a rise in white supremacist groups, etc. Now, to go back to the 1600s,
yes,
it's very interesting. You know, in terms of preparing this book on the 16th century, the 1500s, it's interesting to note that in the 16th century, Spain sent 240,000 of its people to the Americas, to Mexico, to Guatemala, etc. And the English only sent a handful, and that was in the 1580s, to what is now Roanoke, North Carolina. And, of course, as you know, that settlement was squashed by an uprising by the Native American population. But then, in the 1600s, England only sent about 150,000 of its nationals to the Americas. But they were trying to corral Native American populations that were substantially larger, and they were trying to corral African populations that were growing exponentially in the wake of the English takeover of Jamaica in 1655. At the same time, recall that earlier in that century, in about 1600, in fact, the English started moving substantially into what is now India, or what became British India. And so you have this rather small country, the Great Britain, which incorporates, as you know, England and Ireland, Northern Ireland and Scotland and Wales, only has a contemporary population of about 55 million. That's today, 2019. And so they were trying to control this sprawling empire with a relatively small population. And at the same time, what's interesting is that Spain was more sincerely oriented towards religion as an axis of society than Protestant London. That is to say that if you look at the history of Florida, I mentioned St. Augustine, Florida, 1565, the Spanish would send officials to the docks of St. Augustine, Florida, to make sure that any European landing and seeking to become a settler was Catholic. And, of course, no Jewish people were definitely allowed. If they were arriving, they'd probably be tortured and killed. London was much more flexible, and therein you begin to see the seeds of whiteness. That is to say, those who had been warring on the shores of Europe, English versus Irish. You can make an argument that England basically learned the ABCs of colonialism by subduing Ireland over the centuries. Mm-hmm. English versus Scots. One of the central aspects of British history is this age-old conflict between the English and the Scots. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden, once they cross the Atlantic, they adopt a new identity, which is white. And therein, you begin to see that this is an exploitative identity. This is a way to have numbers to confront a robust indigenous Native American population and a growing African population. And the epidermis, if you like, becomes part of the secret in terms of how this exploitative process unfolds, particularly in the 1600s. That is to say, that wealth was accorded on the basis of race. And now, what we see now, just to fast forward in 2019, is that what happens is that over the centuries, there has been this reluctant retreat from the most egregious aspects of white supremacy. That was the import of the anti-Jim Crow movement here in North America. That was the import, in a sense, of the coming to independence of Jamaica in 1962. But what's happening now, particularly in North America, is that when the 45th U.S. president says, make America great again, what he's basically trying to do is turn back the clock. Mm-hmm. And as I sit here today, it's unclear to me whether or not that attempt to turning back the clock will be successful.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that you say it's unclear to you. Most of us take it for granted that it can't be successful. No way. But you're the historian. You're the researcher. You're looking at that, at all of this through the lenses of experience and research. And you're saying that that is unclear.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm going to work like the Dickens to make sure that it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But I mentioned I did this book on the Haitian Revolution.
Yes,
for example.
Yes,
and you know, I'm sure you know the story about. I'm sure you know about Bookman Dotty,
who happened from Jamaica. Yes,
Jamaican,
who led the Haitian Revolution,
who lights the fuse in August 1791 on what was called the island of Hispaniola, that leads to the Haitian Revolution. Mm-hmm. And we know that under the pressure of this revolt of the Africans in Paris, the settler colonial power, they moved by 1794 to abolish slavery. And then we know that that takes place not only in what is now Haiti, but allied French settlements in Martinique and Guadeloupe, etc. But then we see the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte by the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century. And we know that Mr. Bonaparte, Mr. Napoleon, tries to reverse the tide of the Haitian Revolution. They are able successfully to arrest Toussaint Louverture and bundle him off to Europe, but that does not arrest the Haitian Revolution, which triumphs January 1, 1804. However, the abolition of slavery in Guadeloupe and Martinique was reversed. And that is to say, slavery was abolished, then it came back, mm-hmm. and then was abolished again in the 1840s. And so it's not unknown for the clock of history to be reversed, particularly if people are not vigilant. And we all know about counter-revolution. I wrote a book, as you probably know, called The Counter-Revolution of 1776.
Yeah.
Where I argued that when the settlers led by George Washington expelled London from North America, or at least from what is now the United States, that this was a reaction to what they thought was the abolition of slavery in England itself, as represented by Somerset's case in 1772, which they thought would cross the Atlantic, mm-hmm. and then jeopardize the fortunes of slave owners like Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Washington, etc. And so they had a counter-revolution against the abolition of slavery. Fast forward to 1965, you might know I did a book on Zimbabwe,
yes.
and recall that the European settlers there under Ian Smith in November 11, 1965, issued a unilateral declaration of independence because they thought that London was going to be pushing for African majority rule, and rather than accede to that, they decided to declare themselves independent and said that they were walking in the footsteps of 1776.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, that just as George Washington and company revolted against London to evade the logic of abolition of slavery, Ian Smith and the British settlers in southern Africa, what is now Zimbabwe, in November 1965, revolted against the logic of African majority rule. Now, the settlers under Ian Smith lost. The settlers under George Washington won. After George Washington won, the slave trade leaped forward. In fact, Britain then moved towards abolishing slavery mm-hmm. and the slave trade, which they did well before the United States, the so-called revolutionary power. London abolished the slave trade, as you know, months before the United States did. And, of course, the United States abolished the slave trade under pressure from London. Then, circa 1833, 1834, London moved to abolish slavery in its colonial possessions, including Jamaica. The United States dug in its heels, and it took a bloody war involving the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people before the United States decided to abolish slavery.
Mm.
And then, even after that, they erected monuments to the slave owners, which still litter the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to me is a signal that these slave owners in North America have not relinquished the idea of getting their former property back, including people like me.
Wow. And as you talk about that, you know, we the construction of whiteness is something that we're talking about in this segment. But where does classism fall in all of that? Because I'm putting Jamaica front and center in the discussion right now in terms of even when we talk about the construction of whiteness. Talk to us about that within the context of Jamaica and the Caribbean.
Well, it's interesting. As I said, London had a real population problem. That is to say, it was trying to overawe, that is to say, intimidate these enslaved populations. But they had made the decision to conflate class and race. That is to say, in order to be a slave, supposedly you had to be an African or at least have partial African descent. In order to be a slave owner, you had to be a European or what became white. But soon, I would say, particularly in the Caribbean, and to a certain degree in New Orleans and in Charleston and in Savannah, to a certain degree, they found that they had to bolster their numbers, which leads to so-called mixed-race populations, oftentimes allowed to become slave owners. Certainly that was the case in New Orleans and Charleston and South Carolina. Mm. And what that means is that after slavery is abolished, these populations have a leg up in terms of wealth that then helps to feed into this ideology of white supremacy. That is to say that when your worth is determined by your wealth and you and the melanin deficient seem to have more wealth, which seems to indicate that they're more worthy, that helps to create a certain kind of societal structure that I dare say still has resonance not only in New Orleans, Charleston, South Carolina, but also to a certain degree in the Caribbean, and also to a certain extent in Brazil. You might know that, you know, I did this book on Brazil, the deepest South, the United States, Brazil, and the African slave trade.
Yes.
And, of course, Brazil had more enslaved Africans than any other country in the Americas, by several orders of magnitude larger than the enslaved population of the United States of America. The Portuguese had an even bigger problem in terms of numbers. Recall that I mentioned that Great Britain has a contemporary population of about 55 million. Portugal has a contemporary population of about 9 million. And so here you have this relatively small country trying to control this huge territory. Brazil is as large as the United States from the Atlantic to the Pacific, excluding Alaska. And so almost by necessity, in order to maintain slavery and white supremacy, concessions had to be made to the so-called mixed race population to co-opt them and allow some of them to become slave owners. And then after slavery is abolished in 1888, they have an advantage in terms of the newer society that's being constructed because they have wealth based upon this access to slavery, and worth is oftentimes determined by wealth, and so they have a leg up. And that's, in some senses, the story of the Americas.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take another quick break, Professor, and when we come back in the final segment, to talk a little bit now about settler colonialism. So we are reading your text, and once again, just to remind our listeners that the text is The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. Professor will return. We will have a more substantive interview, a more in-depth discussion, and we hope that he will be in the studio for that, that he will take your questions. We're reading this, even if we have to read a page per day or a chapter per day, it is important for us to do so. All right, we take a quick break. We'll be right back.